What becomes of this kind of information? Somebody wants to study something and then reads, and here's this?
It's available for people who, you will have restrictions or the opportunity to determine who can have access to it.
But are these typewritten things then?
Yes, they'll all be transcribed. And you will get a copy to review before.
Who would be interested in this kind of stuff ever?
Well, there are a number of people who are looking at history of science, history of chemistry, company developments. I'm particularly interested in this concept of innovation in an industrial setting. That's why I've been sort of pushing that part of it in our comments.
You know, I know Bill Danforth pretty well. He's the chancellor, maybe you know all this, of Washington University here in town, and for 20 years, and has put Washington University on the map, not only in the medical business, but as a university and endowment-wise and so on. And I don't know, I was arguing with him about something. I guess I was saying, why don't you, when you want to build a department, why don't you go out and get a... What had happened was there were two department heads at the medical school that were entirely unrelated fields that were trying to hire the same guy at the university or someplace in the United States. And I said, Bill, this is a waste. And I said, he says, what do you mean? I said, well, I should think if this one guy here is studying diabetes, he could look up all the great contributors to diabetic technology and go hire some of those guys, and the same with his others. He says, hell, don't you know what a research university is? And I said, I guess not. And he says, it's a collection of buildings where you go out and hire the brightest people you can and let them do their thing. And I figure that's a waste, but anyway. And he cites to the record of Washington University and their association with 6 or 8 Nobel Prize winners at various stages of their career. But if you believe that, you'll run things differently than if you think you're working for Merck.
Well, the university doesn't have stockholders to answer to.
That's right. Are they, don't seem close?
No, I'm heading back tonight.
Have you seen many people here?
Just John Franz at Monsanto.
What's been his history at the company? Has he been in technology or
his whole career? And it's interesting because he fits exactly in the mold of what Danforth said. He said, I wanted to do my research and I wanted to be alone. He was one of these people who didn't feel he could ever be successful in a team approach. He wanted to be creative and innovative, but he wanted to be in his own mind, his own work.
And what led you to him?
He won the Perkin Medal.
And he was, that's yearly, isn't it?
Yes. He won that for his discovery for Roundup. So his approach, that's one of the things that's been intriguing in the people I've talked to so far, is that everyone is different, but successful.
That's why I started out our talk by saying, or said it sometime here, that there's no one glued in bunch of characteristics. Mm-hmm. It depends so much on your surroundings. It depends on the attitudes of the people. It depends whether or not the organization is ready for something. That whatever I had probably wouldn't have been worth a damn at some company like DuPont, where they're dripping with a history of big successes and technological developments. And then a story about whether or not a company head ought to be able to tell the difference between black and white, or whether he just has to read law books or be an accountant. It doesn't seem to make a... Although it seems like to me that historically, I guess it's only because I want to remember what I believe, that successful people, it seems like to me, know something about what they're a success in. I wonder if that's right. They certainly do after they get there. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it's right that that's what is the path.
You made a comment earlier that a number of other people have said too, which relates to luck.
Yeah.
That's not the major part of it, but it plays a role certain in being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
This kinds of stuff that people get by luck or chance unwittingly, it has to do with good work ethic and believing that honesty is a good thing, and keeping their nose to the grindstone instead of finding good excuses not to go to work next Thursday. I think that those are things that prevail probably no matter whether you're a good lawyer or a good salesman or something else, don't you?
And this seems to be a trademark of Mallinckrodt. Integrity, honesty, a good work ethic.
I wonder if it isn't a
trademark of any successful situation. You don't find crooks getting along and for long, I guess. On the other hand, you can have all these high integrity, good sounding things, and not wind up very well either.
Do you think that this integrity characteristic of Mallinckrodt was instilled by both Edward and his father?
Yeah.
The idea that he didn't want to sell because he really wanted to keep his independence.
He didn't want to sell because he was scared, I think. And I think he was really unwittingly, maybe because he was scared, he wanted to preserve what his father gave him and not lose it.
Okay. And that's why he didn't want it, he didn't work on growing it. Because when you
everything that I wanted to do, after I got to know him, to grow it, I knew he was happy with.
He used to tell stories about me around town that once in a while would come back to me. And he was happy with what he had. But why the hell he didn't get it 40 years earlier is too bad for society. And what the hell, if I'd have been brighter, maybe I could have been another Merck. But we got a late start by 20 years or more. That's an excuse I'm giving, you understand?
No, but your record was still a good record. The growth was phenomenal during your time. I have a quote here attributed to you. One of the principal challenges to management is to avoid being surprised.
Well, I'm a sure believer in that.
Did you have surprises?
Yeah, I learned that. I mean, we established a thing finally called the Holds Committee. You ever hear that?
I've read about it, yes.
And what that meant was to avoid surprises and to plug the holes before they got to be big, or to detect holes and set up accounting controls that would let you know gradually when something's going bad, maybe. And that was around the thought that Jesus, let's not have surprises. A major surprise we had was something awful dumb that we did. Awful dumb. You referred to Columbium and Tantalum a minute ago. We were the largest producers of something. I'd forgotten whether it was Columbium, maybe it was both Columbium and Tantalum products for a company called National Research in Boston. And this is run by a guy who was a couple of years ahead of me in school, a fellow named Dick Morris. Anyway, it was one of these materials, Tantalum, let's say. And we became the largest importer of tantalum in the United States, unfortunately, for about 6 months or a year. Oh, this was so dumb. This was about the third year I was president of Mallinckrodt. And the guy that did this, and I knew what was going on, made a contract with some big-time metal people in New York, some big name I forgot, but you remember it. You heard of it. And we contracted for a big stuff that we thought we were going to need for this outfit in Boston, National Research. And I'll be damned if they didn't finally decide they didn't want it. And we got this stuff at $10 a pound or some big number, and it was worth $3. And little old Mallinckrodt in 1962 or three cost $1.25 million or something, which was almost all of our profit for the year. Oh, this was so dumb. And well, we did it. But one of the things that I wanted to do was, we're going to write it off, don't hide it, tell the world we did it. And we came out finally. It didn't suffer much, except we lost the money. But the stock kept going up. But some things are awful dumb that people do, and that was one of them.
Didn't you also have Penn Central stock? Wasn't that another?
Yeah, but that's clearly enough, because of the smart financial fellow we had that I referred to a minute ago. We bought $1 million, so we're $2,500. I think this is right. My recollection is $2,500,000. What do they call those things that companies sold, which were just like certificates of deposits? Companies could sell them. Anyway, we bought $1 million worth, as I remember. And oh, this was awful. Penn Central failed. There was a director from a big-time New York operation, financial underwriters. What the hell was their name? It started with G, and there were two names in it. I shouldn't repeat this, I guess. And there was a director from Kuhn Loeb, or it wasn't Kuhn Loeb, but it was somebody on the board of Penn Central. And he went to a director's meeting on the 28th of seems well as April, that wouldn't make any sense, March, let's say, that Penn Central was going to be in god-awful trouble. And this brokerage outfit, he went back and wrote a note, which our lawyers found in this company's files, that said, dump all these things. So we bought ours on the 29th, after this note had been sent around his organization. Big time, honest guys, you know, integrity all well. And we bought it. And then it failed. And we sued him. And then, of course, it's the discovery procedure and the suit. Say, should you be going?
No, I'm fine.
And sort of, in the course of this discovery procedure, we found that note and other items that were, well, nothing as condemning as that. And what do you know? Before the trial, the head guy of that outfit, he's not called the president of brokerage and the underwriting operations, came out and talked to this fellow, this smart guy named, his name was Brenner, the financial fellow at Mallinckrodt, and said that he wanted to have us withdraw the suit and he'd pay us so much. And we told him no. And then he offered some more money, and I think it was like maybe as much as $700,000 or $800,000 of the million. I don't know where the hell he got that, but and we took it. And this financial fellow from Mallinckrodt said, "And we want the stock in Penn Central along with us." So the hope was that something good would happen. And I'll be damned, the stock did turn out good, and we got about $1.25 million back from our $1 million.
But that was a whole, this is such an awful thing for a company to get caught in that trap, and they, and in Wall Street they live on integrity and honesty and all worldly art wideness, and here was that guy coming and sitting down and I've never understood the discovery procedure of lawyers. I should think before anybody came around to go through your files, you'd go through them yourself and wouldn't leave notes in about dump this stuff, because the companies, they didn't fail, did they? Do you remember this situation? Or maybe they reorganized and their stock became worth something later on.
You mean Penn Central?
Yeah.
Well, they don't exist. Well, I think there's a holding corporation somewhere with that name, but I think that's all. I think Conrail eventually took over all of that. We talked about your acquisitions. That was really, I have here, there were three things that you wanted to do when you started out. One was decentralization, so you set up, you talked about that. The second was acquisitions. We've talked about some of that. And the third part was going international. Was that your emphasis?
Oh, yeah. This fellow who was interested in narcotics that I referred to, his name was Hohmeyer. And I've forgotten how this started. We wanted a guy to... He had been sort of like an executive officer to a guy named Anslinger, who was the first commissioner of narcotics in the United States sometime in the 20s, or early 30s. And he used to take a trip with Anslinger to go to one of these international narcotics meetings. And he was the only guy in the company that had been outside North America. A couple of us had been to Canada. So he figured Gus should take over this job. And Gus is the guy that made the arrangements with the Germans to handle farm radio pharmaceuticals and this material called Conray. And then the same thing went on in Japan. And out of that came, for our size at least, a substantial growth point of the company. And the name Mallinckrodt, for God's sakes, was astonishing. Of course, it's a German name, and they knew this Mallinckrodt or not, didn't make any difference. It sounded, but Mallinckrodt was known all over, a lot more than you'd ever say a company that size would be. See, this another thing that's coming up now is DeGatt. That's going to be the beginning of a giant world two-class society, I think, the haves and the have-nots. And it's going to be a dog-eat-dog thing with who makes what kind of goods the cheapest. And I think that's a hell of a good thing. But it's also a thing that's going to be a real basic variable in international trade and world survival. If you don't make it good and cheap, you're not going to be in business. And the United States, in one sense, it seems like to me, could be called of having had a subsidy of international business down through 40 or 50 or 60 years, when we made stuff, probably through creation, other countries were willing to pay for. And they were new and novel, and we were great at it. And now people can do the same thing and do it cheaper. And we're getting hurt, and we're going to get hurt worse. And there's a company in St. Louis called Kelwood. And the fellow who really built that company is a pretty good friend of mine. And they make men's shirts, among other things. And they had a plant in Sri Lanka. That's an island off India someplace, isn't it? And they built a shirt factory there and paid the women something like 28 cents an hour instead of $3 or whatever they got in the United States a few years ago. And they would get shirts landed in the country at something like $1.80 a piece.
And I said, what becomes of all the waste? Well, he says, that's in $1.80. They aren't as efficient as the United States people, but you can put up with a lot of inefficiency for the difference between 28 cents and $1. 10 times that. Mm-hmm. And this is going to happen all over all the products. The place we're great, I guess, still is in agriculture products, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. You were also very active in community involvement, and you helped that you encouraged company employees also to be active in community affairs. That,
yeah. After Rachel, I was very active in that. This used to bother Mr. Mallinckrodt. He says, you're doing enough pro bono, is that the word? Mm-hmm. And then he'd read in the paper that I was head of the United Way or something, and I'm not sure why I did that, but I liked it very much, and I guess liked the activity and a spirit of accomplishment when you run a United Way organization and the Boy Scouts that works and people get some benefits from it. And I was very active around town and lots of things. I also got to be a director of a number of companies that was a good experience. It probably helped Mallinckrodt. I like to think it did because I spent time in these sort of activities.
The Mallinckrodts were somewhat philanthropic here in the
very
state.
Very. They built the Mallinckrodt Institute of Radiology here, which is a world leader in X-ray diagnostic stuff and treatment. They gave, for the time, I guess it was in the 20s, a chemical laboratory to Harvard University.
Sure.
And they always participated in, I think Mr. Mallinckrodt Sr., who died in 1927, was more of a real philanthropist and a student of the subject than the Mr. Mallinckrodt that I know. But he himself did a lot. He left for the Mounted at the time, when he died, $50 million to Harvard and $25 million to West University. See, that's another measure of the company's change. When he died, in 1960, the company had 500,000 shares of stock at $30 a share. That's $15 million. And we sold this thing to Avon for $780 million or $770 million. And that's one obvious example of the change. And just in the short time, I don't know what the stock was worth if Mr. Mallinckrodt died, but the $75 million that he gave, I've forgotten the numbers, to Harvard and Washington University in St. Louis, must have been worth 8 or 9 times what it would have been worth in 1960. And anyway, I was active around town in a lot of things.
And intrigued by the fact that he was critical of your doing that. So I'm assuming then that while he was philanthropic, he didn't participate in anything himself.
He'd never be a front man or an organizer or a leader or a semi-front man even.
We've talked about the Holes Committee. You also created something called the Office of the Chairman.
Well, that's just another thing that It's a smaller operating committee. We had a chairman and a vice chairman and a president of the company, the office of the chairman, and that the three of us were pretty close in everything that happened. And it gave total knowledge of the company to three people rather than one person. And the operating committee gave most of the same kind of thing to seven people rather than one person. I think it's a nice sounding situation. It sounds as though you knew what you were doing.
I'm not sure now if I have the dates right when the patents expired on the paraminophenol and other players got into the market for acetaminophen. And
well, right now the situation is that this comes from Mallinckrodt people. I don't know how objective it is, but I guess it's true. Are by far world leaders in the manufacture of the material, and we have plants in Germany and England and Ireland, I guess, and a couple in the United States. The biggest one, I guess, is in Raleigh, North Carolina. And this is a phenomenon. You know, the English knew that what now has become Tylenol, that this was an analgesic, and it was successful in England, but nobody seemed to know much about it. And all of a sudden, when was this, the late as the 70s sometime?
Mm-hmm.
Up pops Bristol-Myers and Johnson & Johnson with a product, and Johnson & Johnson is unbelievable what they've done. They pushed our largest narcotics customer for codeine was Burroughs Wellcome in the United States part of that empire. And they were used to have Emperin, and this was the biggest aspirin analgesic, or maybe the biggest analgesic there was. Along comes Tylenol, and there's practically no more Emperin.
Mm.
And Tylenol doesn't have, or at least didn't start out to have, the anti-inflammatory aspect of aspirin. But they're selling Tylenol now for, I guess, for arthritis, right?
As you approached the end of the 70s, you were looking at retirement.